And welcome to Show and Tell the podcast. My name's Monty and I get to chat to some of the most incredible women about their lives, and really nothing is off limits. We record these chats at my house on my couch, so they're super relaxed, they're very raw, and they are extremely honest. Now, if you want to check out the videos, head to showandtellonline.com.au or you can listen to the podcast here. Erin Molan sat down for one of the most emotional on the couch chats I think we've ever had. This journalist is the first ever female co-host of the NRL Footy Show, and she bared so much of herself. It was such a special chat. We had lots of laughs and loads of tears. We touched on everything from being called frigid when we were teenagers to how bowel cancer has affected our families. It's a really powerful chat, and I thought Erin was a great chick before I sat down and spent this time with her, but now I just think she is incredible. Here is that chat. What was your childhood like? Because your dad was in the army.
He was.
So you guys moved a million times.
Yeah, we did. So I was born in Canberra, actually, so I always consider myself a Canberra girl, but went to 16 different schools, so moved all over, which I guess when it's all you know, it's all you know. So I don't kind of have this, you know, didn't have this preconceived idea of what a childhood should be like. It was just basically all I knew and all my siblings knew.
Right.
But I think I loved it. I thought it was amazing. You know, there were times where it was difficult when you became a teenager and trying to make friends. I remember,
yes,
you know, sitting in toilets at high school because I didn't have any friends. And
oh, were,
I know, right? Oh. Help me. I'm a loner.
Oh,
but I think it's made me who I am today in terms of, you know, being able to walk into any situation and be comfortable with people,
yeah,
talking to anyone. And, you know, part of that, you know, moving around experience included two stints in Indonesia, which was just incredible. We were there in, I think, 92 to 96, and then 98, which was when Suharto fell. So, you know, I think I was about 16 years old, and Suharto was the president of Indonesia at the time, and he'd been in power for about 30 years, and the most corrupt government you could ever imagine. His children owned every major piece of infrastructure. It was just, the country was just, you know, in a really bad way, and all of a sudden the people revolted, and you know, they basically stood up for themselves, and there were riots and people were killed. It was this horrible yet amazing thing where Suharto fell and was overturned, and we were there. We had to be evacuated because there were riots,
wow,
and our bus was attacked, and you know, people were trying to get into our house, and we had security guards trying to protect. It was intense, but just to have been part of something so incredible on such a world stage, and to, I wish I was older so I could have appreciated it more.
And
whereas,
what was going on.
Exactly.
Old were you?
I was 16 at the time. So I was more interested in, like, did my hair look good, or
did
that
totally
boy in science like me? His name was Timor. He didn't. But that was what I was more concerned about. But I look back now and I think, well, you know, I speak the language as well. So mum and
you
dad.
You speak fluent Bahasa, right?
Well, fluent's probably being generous. I speak, so I couldn't go into government and, you know, debate different bits of legislation. But day to day going in, so I can, you know, hello, namaste, Erin, besok pagi saya akan pergi ke toko, mungkin saya akan minum susu, saya enggak tahu.
Oh my God,
so I can speak day to day.
Yeah,
okay, if you insist. But it's so it's wonderful. So to be able to kind of have another language, and mum and dad were amazing because so many diplomats go into places like that, and they go from their air-conditioned cars to their air-conditioned houses to their air-conditioned schools to their air-conditioned offices. And they've got staff who are local, but there's no real interaction. People stay very segregated. But mum and dad were like, no, we're going to immerse you in the culture. And we hated it at the time. We wanted to stay home and watch pay TV. But they got us, you know, local Indonesians who took us out to markets, and we played with kids on the street. So I've got really not textbook Indonesian, but real street, which was amazing. And, you know, mum and dad have always been so adamant that we really experience all the different cultures, and I'm so grateful for it now.
Totally.
So it was a really cool upbringing, and dad being in the army, and was just awesome, you know?
Because moving to 16 different schools, like that is, because I remember I lived in a town that had an army barracks there, and so we'd have kids come, and then I'd fall in love with some of the girls, and then I'd be like, oh, fuck, now you're going.
Wait, can we say fuck?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
You can say fucking cunt if you want.
Fuck. I'll stick with that for now because my mum might watch. But that is brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Honey, I'm doing every week now.
And then I'd be like, oh, my God, you're going. But that was, you know, I was in my spot and would make beautiful friends, and then they would leave. So to be that person who is going in, making these friendships and then leaving would be, I would find that so difficult.
It was a lot of the time, and I always remember being jealous, even into my early 20s, of people who would be like, oh, this is my friend Scarlett, we've known each other since we were seven. And I was like, this is my friend Adele, we met last week, and she's my longest term friend that I've got currently. And particularly when you're younger, you don't you know, keep those friendships like you would when you're older. You don't really keep in touch and you have the best of intentions. But, yeah, so I guess, and I think a lot of that has to do, you know, a lot of that upbringing and that childhood and that moving and that always searching for acceptance and searching for, you know, wanting people to embrace you and be friends with you probably has a lot to do with who I am today as well, like both positively and negatively, I guess, even though I think overall it was a beautiful, positive, wonderful experience and I've got two parents who loved me more than anything else in the world. I think there's also elements of that that probably contribute to some things I struggle with, you know, these days. So it's kind of, it's, but I think overall it was just a great experience.
When you say like the things that you struggle with now, is it when you look at your friendships now, do you feel like, I don't even know how to explain it, but because you did, you would get close to people and then have to move.
Yeah.
Do you feel like now kind of people, you don't get too close to people because there's almost ingrained in you that...
That definitely was, I think I'm much better at it now, but that definitely was something, even with relationships and all that kind of thing. And I think always this fear of, not only, even though I was the one always doing the leaving, this fear of being left as well, which was I think something that was through my late teens and early 20s, which was always a big deal for me. And I always wondered, you know, because I've got a great family and everything. And then I kind of thought, well, yeah, probably even friendships, because they're your strongest bonds outside of your family, aren't you, when you're younger?
Yeah.
And particularly when you're going through things like puberty and you know, all those changes that, only having friends for 6 months or a year. And then as you get older, friendship groups, particularly in high school, are so forged and clicky and ingrained. And it's, you know, when you really develop your sense of identity and your resilience and your, you know, how you feel about yourself and your self-esteem, it's such a crucial period. So to kind of be so unsure about so many things, I think, it was difficult.
See, I look at what is kind of my main things that I go to counselling every 2 days for about now.
That's very frequent. Yes, I like it.
Just when I do go, which I'm such a firm believer in counselling too.
Yeah.
Like my partner, I'll go, okay, let's go for a check-in, or otherwise I'm just... like, okay, I'm feeling a bit shit right now. But most of the stuff goes back to your childhood.
Yeah. Like, I used to always watch movies and see that, and the shrinks always say, let's go back to when you were three. And he's looking like, sorry, Otto, is that the best you got? But you're right, a lot of that, because they're very powerful years in terms of forming you as a person, aren't they? So,
I think
definitely a lot of the things, would definitely come from that.
Yeah, and you were one of four.
One of four, yes.
And do you think because you guys moved so much, you were so close to you've spoken about your sister a lot.
Yeah.
Do you think that made you guys extra close as a family?
I think definitely. I think... moving a lot definitely did. My younger sister and I are only 12 months apart, and
we were always
incredibly close. So, and then my little brother is 6 years younger, so he was always the cute little one that came along, and we've always just loved and adored him. And then my older sister is 2 years older, but she went to boarding school, so there kind of was a period there where we didn't, you know, see a lot of her, only when we kind of went home for holidays and that kind of thing. But then, kind of once we all got back home, we're just... now we're so, given, you know, she got ill, she was diagnosed with bowel cancer 5 years ago, my older sister. So when she got ill, that just was next level. But you kind of grow up thinking that every family's like that. And I've always, when I was younger, I thought everyone has two parents that love them and everyone has, you know, siblings that are wonderful and supportive. But as I got older, I realised that's rare. And, you know, when I wanted to go to a party when I was younger and Mum would be like, oh, that's lovely, I'll just ring the parents and check. And I'd be like, the whole freaking point of having the parties, the parents don't know and they're away. And I used to get so frustrated. I'm like, well, Jessie's parents don't give a flying fuck that she's, you know, that she's going. And I used to get so frustrated. And now I look back and think, thank God I had parents that cared and loved me. And, you know, I just think I'm so lucky. And, you know, all of us were raised like that. And, you know, we're really, really close.
How good were those parties?
Oh, they were the best.
Just the house parties. We would have gardens parties.
Did you?
Yeah. So around the corner from my house was the local gardens, and you'd stand out the front of a bottle shop, and you'd, like, a person who was, you know.
Give me.
Yeah, we'd go, can you please buy us, like, 3 UDLs? And then we'd go down to the local gardens.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, I reckon that many kids lost their virginity in the bushes at the local gardens. I freak now going, oh, my God, my kids are going to be going to, like, That's why you go, as a parent, I go, oh my God, what's the better thing to do? You know, when those parents are like, I prefer them to be drinking in my house. I'm not like that. I don't want them shagging in the bushes at the garden
either. It's not ideal. Like, at least on a nice bit of grass. I mean, let's
get
classy.
Town, guys.
No,
like,
I didn't have my first kiss till I was 17. So I was terrified of boys growing up. I was so frigid.
Yes.
Don't worry. They told me that a lot as well.
Yeah.
When I didn't want to hook up with them. Oh, it's just because you're frigid. I'm like, no, it's actually because you're feral.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's call me frigid.
I was like 15 as well. Yeah. I was quite older, but
that's
not 17.
How embarrassing.
But the longer you live, I remember going, I've just got to rip the Band-Aid off now, because the longer I leave it, the more stressed I got about it.
And even conversations like at school, and I never felt like, even, you know, you kind of sit there and girls would talk about, you know, like, even, I know it's even younger now, which is terrifying, but even when I was at school, like 14 and 15, having sex, and I'd just be sitting there like, I'd be too scared to hold hands with a boy.
Me
I'd be
too.
Like, oh,
I would get sick. I remember the first time I kissed a boy, I felt so sick.
Gross.
And then I was like, let's just do it. And it was hideous. And then I was like, okay, it's done.
Yes. Gross.
So funny. But how wrapped are you when the first one's done?
Oh, it's just a relief.
And then
you
I
just
want to
tell
dirty
everyone.
Boy, you know, I was like, bring it on, line up the boys.
Yeah, see, mine obviously wasn't that good because I didn't. I was like, oh, it took me a fair while after that to move on. It's like, oh, that was gross.
That is so awesome, though, to have a daughter that's like, now I'd go, oh.
Oh, I know. Wasn't
it wonderful?
I want a frigid
daughter so bad. I want my boys to be like that too.
Yeah, good luck
funny?
With that.
Yeah. Friends who have got girls, I joke and go, oh my God, my son's totally going to finger your daughter one day. And the parents of the girl's like, uh-uh. And my partner and I are like, yeah!
Oh, I can't imagine they didn't welcome that with open arms. That's so weird.
Brooke is looking going, nah, we're not using anything.
I was about to say, there is total fear on Brooke's face right now.
Yeah,
wow.
She loves it because she's got the daughter, and I tell her that my sons is definitely...
There's no way.
Yes, they are. They're going to love
she
it.
She said there's no way for those who didn't pick up on that.
Now, let's go. So with your career, which is, you are just absolutely a trailblazer, which is so fucking exciting. Let's talk about how you got into it. Like, what was, when did you go, okay, this is what I want to do?
I kind of grew up always either wanting to be a lawyer or wanting to be a journalist. So I kind of, even from when we were living over in Indonesia especially, I used to host news programs that we'd film on our, you know, really old video camera and send back to Granny and Grandpa. So I'd kind of always be sitting in the anchor's chair, and then I'd like make my older sister be... I think she did like reports from the field, and my younger brother did weather, and my other sister did sport. And I'd, you know, we'd make these whole productions, and I used to wear mum's like batik jackets, and I used to love it. So I kind of always grew up thinking I wanted to do something like that. I love telling stories, and that was what I was so passionate about from such a young age. Writing, I used to write so much poetry and get it published in the Canberra Times.
Yeah,
and
right.
I still remember, I haven't thought about this in ages. There's one poem I wrote and I was so proud of it. It went something like, tomorrow is a place you and I shall never be. Tomorrow is a time you and I shall never see. Why have tomorrow when the day shall never come? For tomorrow becomes today with the rising of the sun. And I was so proud.
That
I thought,
so deep.
Deep.
Too.
And I was
yes.
like 11. So I was like, dude, I have a future in this kind of
yes,
shit.
And
I was like, this is next level. Saying it out loud now, not as impressive as
no,
what
I thought. No, it's still, it's all rhymey and nice.
Yeah.
Like, I can do that.
And it makes sense. Like, get it? When the rising of the sun.
I totally
like,
get
tomorrow
it.
Tomorrow
yeah.
becomes today. Yeah. So, from, yeah, so that was my inspiration. So I always loved that element of it. And then kind of, I remember I saw an ad in the paper for TV presenters, which you never see. So I'd enrolled in uni. I did journalism at uni, but I dropped out of uni like 6 times. So I would enroll in journalism then. There'd be like a party or something I'd rather go to, or I just didn't want to do the assignment. So then I'd drop out, and then I'd enroll in another degree thinking maybe I'm just not doing the right degree, and then I'd drop out of that. And so I'd always managed to drop out after the HEX cut off, of course. So
of
I still
course,
had to pay like a full degree's HEX without
oh,
one credit.
Oh, no. You're
one
be
unit of credit.
That off
I know.
Until you die.
Oh, I think I've paid it off now. I'm 32, so you'd hope so. But I did spend the first few years ticking the no HEX box, like when I worked at Macca's and stuff.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
So I
yeah.
think I've paid it off now. But I kind of just. It's bizarre because I had no interest in studying or working hard or doing anything then. Then when I saw this ad in the paper, I went to the audition. I remember sitting outside in the car. Like, I don't know how I even got an audition because I had nothing on my CV except gymnastics coaching and McDonald's.
Right.
And I went in. Well, first I was sitting outside in the car and I had these horrendous sweat marks because I was so nervous.
Oh.
So I had the air on the car and I was trying to dry my sweat marks.
No,
and I had these really tight Sass & Bide grey jeans on, you know, and they were hot.
Yes.
Are they still hot?
Sassanbaji.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah.
Yeah, you're anyway, still so on trend.
Yes, so on point.
Yeah, totally.
And then I slung my leg out, crotch ripped open.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
Not even joking. Like, it'd be a good story if I made it up, but it's actually for real. So I went in, I'm like, I'm really sorry I'm late. I've ripped the crotch open on my jeans. Oh. I think someone made a joke that it would actually probably help my audition. I was like, help me. I was still frigid then, I think. I was 21. So when I went in, read the auto cue, I was horrendous. Like, I just was hopeless. I wasn't natural. It was awful. And they never called, but every week after that, for about 6 months, I reckon it was, I sent the boss of that station an email, just a couple of lines just saying, I know that I can do this. I know I didn't do well, but please give me a shot. Please give me a shot. Please give me a shot. And I think after about 6 months, I remember it was my 21st birthday, and I got a call from a number I didn't know, and I was at uni. I'd re-enrolled.
Right.
Yeah, no other option. And the guy, Steve, his name was, and he said, Erin, it's Steve from Channel Vision. That was the name. He said, if I give you a 2-minute segment on the food show, will you leave me the fuck alone? And I was like, yes, I will. Anyway, from that moment on, I think within a month, I was their main presenter, hosting, you know, business, sport, the whole thing.
And oh, you
it
beauty.
Was still very local and little, but it was my foot in the door. And from then on, from that day on, I think my first at work, I just totally, my work ethic since then, and to my detriment as well, and the expense of a lot of other things, it's all I do. It's my entire focus. It's just not so much now, but, you know, it, going from someone who wouldn't even do an assignment because they couldn't be bothered to just someone who just would never leave a stone unturned. And just, you know, I guess that's what I'll always say is someone might have more talent than me, but no one will ever work harder than me. No one will ever do more prep than me, and no one will ever know more than me. I wish I was more natural and talented because I'd have to work less.
You're doing okay.
But, But I think it's just bizarre because I went from this person who just had no interest in the academia side of things and then just, found my thing.
That is unreal.
Yeah.
You do that. Like when I was trying to get into radio, I would send demos.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of the balance of being, you know, just checking in and then going to
as
full
opposed
pest.
To punish. Yeah. And I then went. So once I got that opportunity, it took me 3 or 4 years to then get an opportunity at Wind TV. And you know, then when I was at Wind TV to try and go national, I had 82 rejection letters that I keep
You're
in a folder.
Kidding.
82. Your writing's not good enough, your look's not good enough, your voice isn't good enough, my voice was horrendous, your voice is horrendous. And people were wonderful, like Kenny Sutcliffe would always send me back, you know, and he'd send me back ideas and suggestions on stuff, but I just, you know, I was never just good naturally. Some people now, some young kids come in and they might do a voice and I'm like, oh my, I sounded like a hyena for the first 6 years that I was, you know, doing work, and I envy them so much, but I genuinely, nothing ever came easily. Like it took me, you know, 7 or 8 years to get to, you know, to national, to Channel 9. And then once I got there, things happened fairly quickly. But, you know, I've done TV, one of my 11, 12 years now. And it's been a long, long, long process. Yeah. People think it happened like that. And it's certainly different. It didn't. I've always had to work incredibly hard for it.
You love sport.
Yes.
And you know so much about sport. You're such a passionate NRL player. Mm. I'm a Melbourne girl. So NRL is...
Fan.
What did I say?
Player. I mean, I could try, but I can't even walk up the stairs here without getting puffed, so it probably wouldn't go down.
Right,
well.
Okay. So you're...
Put me on the wing.
You look so cute in your little shorts.
I was about to say, I would. I do have good legs. I could carry off the shorts.
See, how embarrassingly typical is that? Yep. Like a giggle, they'll go, I mean, so you're a player.
Oh, my God. Could you get some substance, please? See, that's the thing with women, right? We say something like that, and it's because we're such a girl. And
yeah,
girly, but
no, you're right.
My male colleagues say stupider shit than that. That was stupid all the time, but it's funny, and it's because they're blokes.
Yeah,
and,
totally,
you know,
yes.
Therein lies the difference, yes.
But I do love how passionate you are about sport. Mm. Growing up in Melbourne, AFL is the game. You can't avoid it. So it's more, and my partner's so passionate about AFL that I know enough that's going on, and also working at Triple M.
Yes.
You have to know all the players and everything. But you are so, you're so passionate about it, and you know so much about it that you are, you know, it's amazing to watch you and go, look at you, just hold your own in there. You're a co-host on the NRL Footy Show. And Sylvia was saying yesterday, when we spoke to Sylvia, she was saying, the best thing about what's going on with you is that even during the ads that play during the Today Show to promote your show is going, this is what Erin and the boys are up to.
Yeah.
You know, because it's now, it's so centred around you, which is so incredible.
It's amazing. And sometimes I can be very self-deprecating, and that's, you know, that's just a trait that I've got, and I don't, you know, compliments I find really uncomfortable. Yes. And the minute
someone says,
oh, you look pretty, I just, but you look so much prettier. Like, I just, I'm really uncomfortable with it. But sometimes I do have to stop and actually think it's actually really incredible. And
yeah.
It hasn't been easy. And, you know, it's been incredibly difficult at times in so many ways that I couldn't even begin to explain to people because it would sound so self-indulgent because other people have far greater issues and problems. But it has been really difficult.
Yeah,
and
I can imagine.
It's something that I'm immensely proud of. And, you know, and I didn't grow up with rugby league. So unlike, you know, people think that I've loved the sport for years and I'm a tragic. Well, to be honest, when I got the job at Channel 9, I thought, well, if I'm going to be across a sport and get opportunities at this network, well, rugby league's going to be the one. They've got the rights. So I then fell in love with the game and now I absolutely love it. But I grew up with AFL and Union. So
you totally learnt the sport
pretty much
from scratch.
I one of my first TV station, the Channel Vision one in Canberra, we covered a bit of local rugby league. And then when I got to Win TV, I had to start covering the Raiders, but along with the Brumbies and a million other sports. But it was only when I got to 9 that I really thought, I've actually got to learn this game. And I'm still learning. And that's why people say to me, you know, oh, you've broken all this ground and you're doing this and you're hosting. So the next thing for you must be commentary. You know, I know that Kelly's does commentary in the AFL and she, you know, they always talk about, the, you know, women doing that role. And I'm the first to say there is no way in hell I could ever commentate. And I'm the first to say that I'm a host and a facilitator and I can be across injuries. And, you know, I study players and I can talk about form and I can listen to a coach talk about a particular play and then, you know, repeat that and communicate that. But in terms of the intricate knowledge required, I don't have that. And I would never... I think one of my strengths is that I know what I would not be good at.
You know,
and I know that commentary is just not for me. And I think my role in the footy show, people call me an expert sometimes. I'm not an expert at all. You know, I sit there and I have to listen to Ray, you know, commentate and I'll listen to Joey and I'll send Freddie a text and say, hey, that play that just happened there, why do you reckon they did that? Or you made this comment. Can you explain? Because I didn't play the game growing up. I'm still learning the game. And I'll say, can you explain to me? But I have this appetite for knowledge. So I'm not an expert. I'm a host and a facilitator and I'm pretty good at running a show and I can throw to packages and generate discussion and I can bring up ideas and I can study, but I'm not an expert. And I've never tried to be. And I think that's one reason why it's worked so much. I think you have to earn the right to shit can someone or to have an opinion on something. And, you know, it's only really recently that I've started even very subtly expressing my opinion on the show because I don't want someone who's, you know, the guys surrounding me are legends of the game. So I'm happy to sit there and facilitate and, you know, I'll have an opinion on other things. But I think that's one reason it's worked so well is that I haven't been pushy and I've known my role and I've known my place. And that's not saying I don't deserve it or if there was another woman who played the game or who not even played the game but understands it intricately, bring it on. It's not a gender thing for me.
Yes.
It's the fact that I don't know the game well enough to commentate.
Right.
So I'm, you know, I know my role and I know my strengths.
When you first got the job on the show and you were the first female to host that show, when they offered you that role, because I, you know, and Beck Madden now hosting the AFL footy show, I felt anxiety for her when she got that role going, this is a really big role and I don't know if you would feel this, but I would feel like you're representing female voices in the sport.
It's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about, you know, what I've done on the footy show and not even what I've done, but what the footy show has allowed me to do and giving me that opportunity and is the amount of women that come up to me, 90-year-old women, 50-year-old mums, 12-year-old girls. You get a lot of blokes who come up and, you know, that's lovely and wonderful, but the amount of women that come up and say, oh, thank God, you know, I sit there, you know, used to watch with my husband and I try and say something, he'd be dismissive. Now I say something, she said, and because you're on the show and it's almost like you've given women credibility and they actually, you know, she said, my husband now actually listens to my opinion ever since you've been on the show because he's now actually used to listening to a woman say something that he actually respects and that he agrees with. And I just love that it's kind of changed the balance, even in one relationship. I just think it's, hopefully that's emulated, you know. But I just think it's a huge privilege and I don't ever take it for granted. It's, you know, and I'm sure there's a lot of women out there who can't stand me, but, you know, that's life. I think, you know, it's nice to be able to represent the majority.
Totally. And it is just, you know, and I guess that it's also that fine balance of going, you know, and also with radio, you were so outnumbered in, you know, any team that I've worked in, except I'm doing one of the first I'm on an all-female show at the moment, which is just incredible.
Amazing.
But normally it would be two guys and a girl, and I just go, especially with
to
sport.
To fill a token role, like if you could just laugh at their jokes or you could, you know. Yeah,
and Chrissy Swan's really openly spoken about that her role was to support at the start. She wasn't even really allowed to laugh unless, and Jackie O has spoken out with, you know, Kyle's spoken about how Jackie would, to start with, you know, her role was laugh. You know, like point to and laugh. Not with Kyle, he changed that for her.
Yeah.
But just the typical role, it's so exhausting. And then I go, in sport, in AFL and NRL's not, it's quite similar. Probably, I don't think as many women attend the games, but it's 50% in AFL.
Wow.
So I'm like, my brain rattles when I go, why is there only one woman on a footy show when it, literally half of the audience are females.
Totally. And that's and the fact that it's still considered a big deal, or it's still considered special, or it's still considered something that's worthy of bringing attention to.
Yes.
And that's what's terrifying.
Like, I love this conversation, but it annoys me at the same time.
And that's why I can't wait for the day when I'm not asked about being a woman on the footy show. Yeah. Now it's legitimate because it is a big deal.
Yes.
It hasn't happened enough and I'm the first one to do it and all that kind of thing, but I cannot wait until it's just so normal that it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
So, which will be a really great day.
And I hope we're getting there bit by bit, bit by bit.
Yeah, and we are, and there's more and more, and networks are really embracing that. And it's the same as older women on television. You know, you look at the audience of news at home, and they're always saying, you know, every time we write a story, when I first started at Nine News, you know, one of the producers would say, you know, think about my 50-year-old mother, my 60-year-old mother, you know, listening to this. That's who you're talking to. They're our core audience. That's our, and if they're our core audience, then why the fuck are we getting rid of women who are 30 because we think they look too old?
Yeah.
They're, you know, women at home don't want to watch some, you know, a 20-year-old who has no idea what they're talking about. Put women on TV who reflect women at home and who can communicate and who they can relate to. And
totally.
You know, and that's what I love about our networks now is that there are more and more women who are older and older. I used to always joke and say, I'm 30 next year, so, you know, I won't have a job in TV. I'm done. I'm going to retire. But it's just, you know, it's not happening anymore.
And it is, I think, it's changing a bit more.
It is, which is wonderful. We shouldn't be grateful for it. Oh, thank you so much for allowing us to stay in your networks after we're 30.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's better to be going that way than the opposite.
Totally, absolutely. When you first started, and, you know, I'm sure it still happens now, as it was, you know, Beck Madden's first show, and even I watched, I was like, you know, how is this going to go? And the feedback that she, and I was speaking to my partner Sam, and I was looking through Beck's photos and the footy show's photos and just the comments under from guys and girls. Yeah. Sometimes when I look at the comments, I'm like, there's a female's name next to that revolting comment.
I know. It is horrendous. And that's, you know, I've had to really learn to become very resilient to that kind of stuff because people think you're on TV and they think, you know, they almost think that you don't have emotion and you don't feel, and it's like, you know what? I think that I'm strong and I'm tough, but I'll tell you what, I'm also a woman and I also get my feelings hurt.
Yeah.
And I also read something that makes me feel sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
And I can go through days where I wake up and I feel like I'm not good enough and that, you know, I feel insecure, I feel anxious, I feel all these things. And I just think, I don't normally reply to things because I'm very, you know, you just can't. You can't win, and it's just, there's too many of them, to be honest. But sometimes I'll see someone and I'll click on them and I'll look and I'll see, you know, they might have a profile picture with a daughter or they might be there with their girlfriend. And I won't do it publicly because I'm not into shaming people. But a couple of weeks ago, I sent this bloke a message. He'd written something, you vile, horrible woman, go die. You are the most ugly, disgusting piece of shit I've ever seen. You know, I hope you die. I don't know why I'm getting emotional because it actually didn't really bother me that much at the time. But I read it and I looked and I saw that he had a daughter in his phone. I just sent him a message. I said, John, don't know if his name was John, I saw your comment on my Instagram. First of all, that's your opinion. You're very much entitled to it. But I'd really appreciate next time if you could maybe just say it to your friend and not write it on my post.
Right.
You know, my family see that. And I said, secondly, I see you've got a little girl. She's absolutely beautiful. Imagine if someone on the street said to her that she was ugly and vile and you hope she died. I said, I'm someone's daughter.
Yeah.
And I said, that really, you know, it could hurt someone that might not be as strong as me and might, you know, take it to heart and really have impact on them, you know.
Totally.
Anyway, he never wrote back, never did anything, but I thought, even, you know, if that just made him think that actually it might be funny to him, or he's there with his mates and they think, oh, she's a knob or she's a mole, let's, you know. But it actually can really, I've learnt to become really resilient to it, but I know there are people out there who read that stuff, and we've seen examples, people like Charlotte Dawson, who was very public about being really affected by it. And I think actually, You know, every 12-year-old girl who reads that on my Instagram, people call me fat sometimes. People talk about how I look. And I think they're reading that thinking, oh, well, if she's fat, this man
exactly.
thinks she's fat.
It's
I
so
must
dangerous.
Be fat.
Yeah.
I'm 12. I'm not strong enough or old enough or mature enough to realize that he's just a fucking loser.
Yeah.
He's got nothing better to do. So
yeah.
I'm going to now start dieting and be conscious of my weight. And, you know, and it's
the ripple on effect of a comment can be really damaging.
And I'm so passionate about people feeling good about themselves because we're in a world that's constantly trying to make us not feel good about themselves that I feel almost sometimes it's my duty to call people out on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, it's unnecessary. And I'm lucky in that I was gradual on the footy show. You know, I started doing a 5-minute injury segment. Then the next year I was on the panel full time, but just off to the side and just had a little bit role before I was made host. So it wasn't as intense as Bex would have been, but there's nothing you could say to me now that I haven't heard before, or, you know, it was horrendous at the start. It's much better now. I don't ever look at the photos on the comments on the footy show or the Instagram because I know they'd just be vile. My family used to have a look.
This is so not okay.
It's not. I'd love to be able to go and get feedback on, you know what, if people insulted my journalism or said, you know, what you said about that player, bullshit. I'd be like, oh my God, hallelujah, bring it on. Or debate me about my hosting style. Or if you say, you know, I don't like how you do this or, you know, in terms of some fucking substance, like insult my substance, like what I say. Or if you say you don't articulate that word well, I'd be like, brilliant. Mum sometimes says, you forgot your middle T in 20.
Yeah,
like when you say 20, sometimes I'm like 20.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
oh,
that's great feedback.
Yeah.
Like, give me feedback on what I say and what I, you know, do. Don't fucking comment on my dress or my hair or my makeup or my looks or my aesthetic.
It's just
that's
exhausting.
What's frustrating
Absolutely.
For me. Absolutely. It's frustrating.
And you would have had to do a lot of work just to put it into a place, you know?
I used to ring up Mum and Dad and I'd be, you know, after a show, I would feel physically ill going through Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember Dad saying to me, if you're going to get this affected, because he said this is not healthy, if you're going to get this affected by it. And I'd never show anyone at work, you know, no one at work ever knew that I'd, you know, he said, you're in the wrong industry. And I was like, you know what, you're right. And as long as the people who love me, you know me and respect me and, you know, my bosses know who I am and respect me, they pay my wage. So that's
totally,
really important.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the people I care about know and respect me, then that's enough for me.
Yeah.
So,
Do you find working with men that you have to be stronger in who you are? Like, I sometimes find when I'm working with men, I do go more blokey because I'm a blokey girl anyway, but I'll get caught up in their jokes and, you know, and play along because I love, you know.
You have to.
Yeah.
And what I think people often ask me, what was the hardest part about being the first woman in this kind of area? And I'll tell you what I've had to work the hardest at, and this is more than learning players' names and injuries and getting, you know, my info and prep and all that kind of stuff, it's the relationships with my co-hosts.
Mm.
That's what I invest, not so much now because hand on heart, we are the bestest of friends.
Yeah.
Fatty, Bo and Big Man are three of my closest mates. Fatty rings me 4 times a week just
beautiful.
To chew the fat.
Yeah,
you know, he'll ring me up and he'll say, oh, did you get that email from Glenn? I'll be like, no, I didn't get it. Oh, just while I've got you, I was just watching this replay of an 82 game that I starred in myself. And like, it's Big Man and I talk all the time. Bowie and his wife and I are great, man. And it's just so lovely. But that doesn't just happen. Like, I had to invest a lot of time early on in having a relationship with my co-hosts.
Mm.
And so that when we're on air, there was no Veronica Corningstone. When I didn't want to be feeling on air if I said something that they'd all kind of turn the other way or they'd roll their eyes.
Yeah.
You can tell when you're watching a show.
Oh,
if people on a panel don't respect the person that's talking or are dismissive of them or you know, think they're there in a tokenistic role. And so
totally.
I was really, really, and I was, you know, I showed vulnerability to them and I was really adamant that I had a good relationship with them because I knew that I would not survive on that show unless I did.
Really safe then.
I did. And now I know they've got my back and now, you know, but I had to work hard. It didn't just happen. You don't forge those friendships or relationships like that. I had to really invest. And you're right. Like, you know, if I was the kind of girl that was going to be offended if we're sitting in a room and a chick walks by and one of the blokes goes, oh, she's got good tits. And, you know, if I was going to be like, you know what?
Yeah.
That was totally inappropriate and I'm not comfortable with that and, you know, I wouldn't be on the show either.
No.
And that's not saying that I think that that's great or I condone it or that I'm not a feminist or that I, you know, but that's fucking life.
It's life even with your mates. So
exactly.
That's
and that's why we're mates, you know.
Yeah.
And like, I think I'll say to a girlfriend of mine, oh, that bloke's good looking.
Yeah.
Except Sean, you're the only one I think is good looking. But, you know, that's what people do. But if I know that there are women who would get offended by that. And if, you know, I would not be on the show if I got offended by that. So I'm also, in so many ways, I'm so easygoing.
Yeah.
But in
and
other ways,
it's like if you're offended, you'll say something.
And that's it. And yeah, I've done that before. Yeah. You know, I've been in a situation where someone publicly has crossed the line and I have stood up to that. And I always will. But I'm also not precious.
Yes.
And I'm really easygoing. And that's just, you know, part of my nature.
Yeah. You just spoke about Sean. Uh-huh. How did you guys meet?
We met at the Quidju Pavilion. So that old chestnut. Right. Yes. So he, I was there with some girlfriends actually, and we'd just been to a, I wasn't actually going to go. I'd just finished news and gotten off air and the taxi wasn't there and I was sitting in my car about to go. And then I'd rung my girlfriend and said, I'm not coming. You girls have been out all day. And I'm just, you know, anyway, then the taxi arrived and my friend Ash was like, no, come. So I got out of the car and went. And then he was pretty much the same. He wasn't going to go, but then his friend kind of convinced him and he was just out with another mate. And we walked in and then I get really like.
I know, look at you. Everything about you changed, like your demeanor, everything.
I know. I'm now like, it's bizarre, isn't it? But no, yeah. I saw him and he's quite tall and I just saw him and I was like, oh, he's really gorgeous. And I'd broken up with, you know, a fairly long term partner about probably four months or something before, and that had been a pretty horrible breakup. So I kind of wasn't really interested in anything else. I was just, but yeah, I saw him and he kind of looked over and he smiled and I was like, and he had these like cute dimples and anyway, but then he
go and talk to you first?
Well, no, soft, very soft, but he kept looking over and I was making it, you know how you've got to give them enough because men are more insecure than women. So I was like, really subtle. Anyway, he still didn't come over. So a girlfriend went over to the bar to get drinks and then he was at the bar and then I think she asked him to help carry the drinks or something. Then he came over and it kind of went from there, but he's lovely and he's a bit older than me, so he's 40, so it's kind of, it's just, yeah, I don't know, it's kind of, it feels weird because I've got to remember I'm being filmed now, but no, I'll still be there. He's really lovely and he makes me better and he makes me, I don't know why I'm getting emotional, it's really embarrassing.
No, it's not at all.
No, it's just, because as you know, like, you know, with all the, he makes me just feel better about myself and I'm getting
so
emotional.
Oh, you're so beautiful. Now you make me
cry. No, I just, I guess when you're in our industry as well, it's just, it's, it can be very insecure and very lonely.
Yeah.
And, and he's just, yeah, I'm very lucky.
Oh my God. And he's very lucky too. You're beautiful.
He
is, my God.
No, he's beautiful and he's just a really, he's normal. He's just nice and he's normal. And
do you love that he's not connected to at all?
He's not connected at all. He's, you know, he's a policeman. So he's got, you know, he's got a great job and he's really successful, you know, in doing that. But he just, he just makes me feel really special. And it's nice to come home to someone who's, you know, he's not even Logie's, you know. It's not his world and he didn't, you know, he said to me, if it means something to you, of course I'll come. But otherwise, you know, he's like, you know, and I love that about him, that he's not, doesn't want to come to all the events. And, you know, I'm so private about stuff when it comes to, you know, just my family and friends and stuff that it's just, he's just beautiful. He's really good for me. He makes me, you know, I'm healthier. I eat better. I go on the treadmill, mind you, only for about 5 minutes walking.
Is he really
it's on
into
incline
fitness?
Though. Well, he is, but he hasn't been to the gym recently. We've been a bit cheeky, but he's quite fit. He looks, he's gorgeous.
Do you work out together?
Not really.
I
we're
really
going to start.
No,
well,
don't.
Not together, but we keep saying we've got to join the gym. But no, I do like 3 kilo dumbbells for about 3 minutes and then a 5 minute walk in the treadmill.
Yeah, beautiful.
But no, we're not one of those.
I see couples work out together, and apparently Khloe Kardashian said that it's quite a romantic, intimate thing to do.
Yeah, couldn't think of anything worse, to be honest.
But when I see couples jog and stuff, I'm like, don't do that, guys.
Even like when I'm doing like the dumbbells in front of the TV, like the only thing I'll say is, can you get out of the way of the TV because I'm trying to watch the football. I'm like, why don't you give me technique advice? I'm like, it's like they're 3 kilos. You know, technique advice. But
go
no, we're, I'm very, if he kind of, remember going on a date with this guy who like took me to this lovely restaurant, this is years and years and years ago, and he like ordered a sparkling water. And I was kind of like, and then I think salad dressing on the side. And I'm like, you know, I'm all for like each to their own, whatever makes you happy. But unless you can have a beer and a bloody Parmigiana.
Yeah, that's
then,
boring.
Yeah, I just know it wouldn't work for me because I love food. I love wine. I love all of that.
Isn't
that
funny that's really unattractive of a guy to order a salad with salad dressing on the side?
On the side. I'm like, salad, like, where are the carbs for starters? I'm not really a salad girl. But I'm trying to be healthier and trying to be better. But, yeah, I kind of just, that was a big off-putting thing for me. So I love someone who can just indulge and, yeah, you know, because yeah, that's beautiful. What life's about.
Totally. Yeah.
You are an incredible ambassador for Bowel Cancer Australia, and you got into that role because you experienced it firsthand with your family, your beautiful older sister, who's so young, and you automatically go, too young.
Too young.
That won't happen. Oh, no, you know. Talk me through when you found out that your sister was diagnosed with bowel cancer.
Yeah, well, it had, she'd had a rough run. She's when she was 26, she lost her little girl, Emily. So she basically carried Emily full term and went into labour in Swan Hill Hospital, which is a little town. She's a school teacher. Yeah, I remember I was working at Wagga at Wynn at the time, and Dad called me and said, you know, this is kind of the start of it, and said, you know, Sarah's lost Emily, and it was horrendous, and, you know, we all went, and I remember people saying to me at the time, oh, but thank God that, you know, she wasn't like 2 or 3 years old, because that just would have been really hard. And I say to people who say that to me, if you were at the funeral where that little girl's casket, you know, and my big sister got up and said, Mummy's so sorry that she couldn't save you, and Mummy loves you, and Mummy will see you soon. The bond that, and I don't know it because I don't have children, but the bond that a mother forms with a child over that 9 months, as my sister tells me, you cannot, you know, the pain that she felt, you cannot say is any less than someone who lost her, you know,
no way.
A 1-year-old or a 6-month-old. So I used to get really frustrated with that. Not that anyone means any malice by it, but yeah, so that was, you know, and it took, you know, we all wanted Sarah to, you know, move back to Canberra where we could support her, but Emily's buried in Swan Hill, so she goes to her grave every day and, you know, visits, it's her little girl, you know, so she'll never leave her. So you think, you know, and it's been 7 years now, so you kind of think that just shows you, you know, that, so she'd had a rough trot, and that's, you know, anyway, so a couple of years after that, she got pregnant again, which was beautiful, and you know, it was really hard because she, you know, obviously it brought back a lot, and she was, the entire pregnancy, she was terrified because of what had happened with Emily. And anyway, she started to not feel well during the pregnancy. And as any woman would do, they'd think, oh, it's just a side effect of the pregnancy, or, you know, she attributed it to things like maybe my diet's, you know, I should cut gluten out. She went to doctors and they said, oh, just eat less bread and I'll do all this kind of stuff. Anyway, she gave birth to Angus, and then it's still, she was not okay. And Angus is beautiful, healthy, this gorgeous little boy. She already had Sophie before Emily, so Sophie was kind of 5 at this stage. Mm-hmm. And she went in, gave birth, and then they said something's not right. And then they, I remember sitting in the hospital with her, and the doctor came in and said, we've got the test results back, and it's stage 3-4 bowel cancer, which is pretty bad. And yeah, and it's just mind-numbing, you know.
Of course.
Did I get that saying, mind-numbing? I didn't do your
I
skin
so.
Mind-numbing. Anyway.
I know
and
what
it was,
you mean.
Yeah, yeah, but she was just, you know, amazing. She was, I've never, you know, I fell apart, my mum fell apart, everyone just kind of, but she was the one that was just so strong and so resilient throughout this whole thing, and, you know, just incredible. And what made her sad, I think, you know, she couldn't hold Angus for 6 months, you know, because she had her bowel removed, then she was getting chemo, radiotherapy, all this stuff, and...
God. And how old was Angus at this stage?
Angus was just born, so a month or something when all this was happening. God. And Sophie was, you know...
As if this woman hadn't been through
enough. No, exactly. So then she was kind of...
For one lifetime, then to
deal
with this.
And I remember when I did... This is what killed me when I did, you know, the story with her years after, because she didn't tell us how scared she was at the time, because she just was more concerned about us being okay. But she said to me when I sat down with her a couple of years ago, she said, you know, at the time, she said, I thought... You know, I've got these 2 beautiful children who I love and I would never want to leave. But she said, if it's my time, then at least I'll be with Emily. And she said, you know, they'll have their dad. And she said, at least I can go and be with my other baby and, like, she won't be alone. And I just, you know, the fact that she was thinking that and couldn't communicate that to us because... You know, she would never even say that she was scared or that she'd even contemplated that it might not work out. And you just think she went through all that alone because she didn't want us to be sad or to think that she was... Because it's almost worse than worrying, like what I got upset about was thinking about her being scared and upset yeah. more than anything else. And yeah. so she was so conscious of that. So she hid all that throughout. And but that's the thing, I sit here and I cry and then I'm like, well, God, we are the luckiest people in the world because, you know, she has a colostomy bag and she's, but she's fine now. So that's why people say, oh, it's amazing all the stuff you do to raise awareness. I'm like, if she hadn't have lived, I don't know if I would be strong enough. You know,
but she's a miracle.
But she's, you know, she's alive. So it's almost yeah. my God-given duty, I think, now to use every platform I can to spread the message and to save other lives. And, you know, a young girl, I went to a funeral yesterday for a 27-year-old who discovered she had bowel cancer after watching our story, and her dad contacted me and I then contacted her and we you know, spoke once a week on the phone about her treatment, and she passed away last week and went to her funeral. And the whole time I'm sitting there thinking, she is no more worthy. You know, my sister is a beautiful person and this girl was, and
yeah.
my sister's no more worthy of living than she is. You know, and to see her dad get up there, and her dad said the most beautiful thing. He said, you know, in this life, he said, I want to talk about Katie, but I can't, because he said, I just won't be able to. He said, but I read this the other day. He said, it's an ancient Indian saying, and it says that in this life, you die twice. He said, you die when you take your last breath, and then you die when people stop saying your name and stop yeah. talking about you. And he said, please don't let her die twice. Like, yeah. talk about her, love her. And I thought, that's just so beautiful. And
yeah.
they got an extra 12 months with her because they saw the story and they got tested, and it's so curable if you find
yep.
it. So,
yep.
you know, that's, as I was saying earlier, with skin cancer, we grow up, slip, slop, slap.
Yep.
With smoking, you know, we grow up and we get told, don't smoke, you'll get lung cancer. With breast cancer, we get told from a young age, check your breasts, do breast tests. No one talks about bowel cancer because it's gross. It's poo, it's yeah. bums. You don't go for coffee with your girlfriend and say, my bowel movements haven't been regular this week.
Yeah.
So yep. people have the symptoms, but have no fucking idea what they mean.
No.
They say, oh, no. I'll go off weight, or I'm just going through a phase, I need more fibre.
Yeah.
You know, but the more awareness we raise, the more people actually think, actually maybe, because 98% of people can be cured. That's so high.
Yeah.
If
more
it's
people
found,
can be cured from it as well, then we'll pass away from
totally.
It.
Totally. So, and that's why the yeah. stats are in everyone's favour. All we need is for people to just think, maybe. And yeah. you know what? It's probably not. 99%
yeah, exactly,
of cases
yeah.
it won't be, but get tested
yeah, and
eliminate that.
Yeah, sometimes you probably go, oh, it's a bit dramatic to, you know.
Totally. And we're all guilty of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of saying, oh, I don't want to be one of those people that, you know, I hurt my finger and I think I've got, you know, cancer. But it's just eliminate
totally.
The possibility
absolutely.
So that not only you but your family, you
yeah.
know. So it's, yeah. yeah, I'm really passionate about that.
And you are doing such an incredible job. And I told you that my mum has bowel cancer, and she got it about 4 years ago now, about maybe 3.5 years ago. And
yeah.
she was just having tummy pains and
yeah.
she ignored it.
Yeah.
And then got...
As we're all guilty
yeah,
of.
Totally. Yeah, totally. And also you don't, you know, she looks back now and kicks herself, why didn't I check it earlier? You know, the what ifs. And,
yeah.
And then we got it taken out and it was, he's like, it's all clear. I got clear margins, and then it came back and went to her liver and her lung. And that, her delivering that news on, it was Boxing Day a couple of years ago, and it was more scary then than the first time. The first
yeah.
time was kind of like, oh, you know, I've got cancer, but it's gone. It was, so it's not really.
Yeah.
And I just remember going, my mum's going to die. My mum's going to die. And I remember getting up from mum telling me, I said, I just need a minute. And I walked to the bathroom and I couldn't breathe. That's when I had a panic attack. And I'm like, I can't live here without my mum. Like, I don't exist without my mum, you know?
Yep.
And then we got rid of it again. It was like, oh my God, for 2 years she was
yep.
clear. And it's come back on her lung. But they're microscopic. The doctor's like, it's like pinheads. They're like,
but
pinheads,
you know, that's
on your
common
lung.
As well, to come like tiny, tiny, tiny.
Yeah.
So they'll fight that.
And she's having fortnightly chemo.
Yep.
And our doctor is incredible. Our oncologist is so incredible.
But you know, if they've done more cancer twice before and she's come out clear, her body responds to treatment. That
totally.
Is amazing.
She's amazing.
She is obviously amazing. And she, you know, if it's tiny little things just in her lung, they will beat that.
Yeah, we're keeping
yep.
it at bay. And he's like,
yep.
let's think of this.
Because
like,
you know what? They will be honest with you. The one thing I've found with
yeah.
these surgeons and doctors, it is not in their interest to give you, with Katie, they didn't give her false hope.
Yeah.
Probably to her. She wanted them to and they wouldn't.
Yeah.
If your doctor is saying that to you, darling, that is fucking amazing.
And every time we go in there, we hold our breath and that anxiety every
yeah.
3 month scan. But he's like, let's think of it like diabetes
yeah.
or rheumatoid arthritis or something. Like, people, you've got to, if you don't treat that, you're going to die with diabetes. So he's like, we're treating it.
Yeah.
And this is your thing. We're going to look at it like that. And every fortnight, my mum goes to chemo and she gets anxiety around that, but he's working on that. And she's so strong. But like your sister, the other day she said to me, I was just in the shower going, why me? And I hate the thought of my mum doing that on her own.
That's what actually kills you, isn't
it?
Is thinking about them in pain and thinking about, but you know what, they're the most, it's so bizarre that it happens to the most, because I'm like you in that if anything happened to her or my mum or my, like I just wouldn't, I could not, I guess we all don't know what we're capable of, but I would just fall to, I just could not even fathom it.
Yeah.
But they are just, the people that, if you believe in God or whatever, that he these fights to are just the most incredible people.
Oh, my God,
and
so
God,
incredible.
We're fortunate.
You know what, like I was saying, speaking to Stace, who works with us here on Show and Tell last night, she was just saying how in love her parents are.
Oh, and how beautiful. I love
just
it.
Just the best, and we're going how gorgeous it is. But then it crosses over to going, you get scared when there's that, when they're so in love. And that's what I think, like with my mum, she's getting older. Like, she's still fucking amazing. But I'm like, oh shit, man, we're all going to die. Like, we're just destined for so much pain.
We are. And it terrifies. Like, when I was little, I remember you used to, like, 8 or 9 years old, I'd have this. I went through the stage where I obviously learned about death and mortality and going, my mum and dad are going to die one day. My mum and dad are going to die. And even like, I have to sometimes just, I can't do it. Even when my granny says, oh, darling, when I'm gone, I'm like, granny.
Yes.
Don't. I can't. I cannot deal with it. I can deal with some shit, but people dying,
and
I love.
I don't care about myself dying.
Me
I
neither.
Never think about that.
The only thing I would be upset about is that my mum and dad and other people would be hurt, which is really quite weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't care about that. It's more just other people
around
and,
you.
Yeah.
Sometimes it cripples me. Sometimes at night I'll be just to my partner saying, I'm like, life's really scary. And
it
he's like thinking about something else and I'm just
who's playing football
going,
that night. Yeah. It's bizarre, isn't it, how sometimes our minds work in that. But it's, but then I guess you just have to embrace it. And that's why you wake up and you just think, we're so lucky.
Totally.
And that's why even with Sarah, I get sad that she's got a colostomy bag and she can't wear a nice dress.
Yeah.
And it makes me sad. I'm like, you're 33, you should feel beautiful. But then I just think, you know what?
You're alive.
You're alive and we're so lucky.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
I first met you at Cosmo Fun Fearless Awards.
Yes.
And then when you accepted your award, I'm like, this girl's amazing. You were so gorgeous, because I'm like, and I think I called you and I'm like, Erin Mullen's amazing. She's a bogan. She's like us. Like, I loved it.
I love it.
And when you were up there, you spoke about how Delta Goodrum really helped you out when you were getting online trolled quite a lot.
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
It was quite, she came on the Footy Show probably 2 or 3 years ago, and that's when I met her, and she's just such a lovely, lovely girl. Anyone who's met her will say the exact same thing. And she's as lovely to the cleaner as she is to, the boss of Sony or to any other superstar. She's a really lovely girl. And I remember, I'd read articles about her copying it quite a bit online. And, I think it was actually there'd been something, I'm trying to think what the actual, there was something anyway, I'd worn something on the Footy Show or something, of course it was to do with how I looked, not with anything else. And I'd just gotten this barrage of just horrific, really nasty comments. And I don't, I'd kind of gotten over taking it personally, but I'd made some comment to my boss about it and just said, I'd love them to, why don't they have a go at Daryl's suit or fucking, Bo's tie or something. And then he'd had a meeting with Delta that day and had just mentioned, oh, Erin's copying a bit of shit. Anyway, and then I was driving to the airport and this number came, her number came up and she was calling me and I was still like fangirl because still in my head I'm like this, nobody who, I'm like, oh my God, it's a Watch Your Neighbours, like, wow. And I do get excited by some people.
Totally. I still do by like Neighbours people and stuff. Sometimes I'm like, oh, she's in Neighbours.
Do you remember Selena from Home and Away?
Yeah.
She used to wear like the little skirts. I used to like Selena and
Dita
Brummer. She wore the tencel wrap skirts.
And her name's so familiar.
Selena.
And it was the time of like Melissa.
Yeah, Melissa George and Angel and Dita.
Did you used to do the Neighbours Home and Away combo?
Well, I never really watched Neighbours. I don't think Mum and Dad let me, but Home and Away I loved. And I had Dita Brummer, was my man crush. Had him on my wall, and then he got caught with drugs, and Mum made me take down all the posters. I remember her taking them down. I was like, not really understanding what was wrong with drugs or what they even were. But
God, it's so good.
It's so hot. But Delta rang, and she was just beautiful. And she spent probably 40 minutes on the phone with me. And we'd only kind of met on the show and, we weren't best mates and, and she said this thing to me that, because I get, we've spoken about all the assholes, but I tell you what I do get, and that is some of the most amazing, beautiful, kind, generous feedback in the world from people, and I get a lot of it, and I'm, And that's so lovely. And we don't talk often enough about, you know, the people that write in or that will, you know, write on my Instagram lovely, nice things. And I get way more good feedback than I get bad, which is really nice. And she just said that, you know, the way she sees it, in the street, no one will ever walk up to her and say, you're really annoying on The Voice, or you're ugly, or you're crap, or you're shit. She said, everyone on the street will come up to her and say, you're beautiful, you're amazing, you're so kind, I love you on The Voice, you're this and you're that. And she's like, it's those people that you need to listen to. And she's so true, because when I'm out and about, people say the most lovely things.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, it's the people who are sitting at home on computers and trolling behind, you know, usually, you know,
just
people who just...
Keyboard warriors.
Yeah. And she, you know, and that just made me think. And I thought, actually, every person, no one has ever come up to me in the street and said something nasty, ever, to my face. It's always been, I thought, actually, you know what? So that will now be my, you know, I will, if it's online that's good, then I'll take it.
Oh, totally.
Hell yeah. Ain't nobody got time for not taking it. But if it's online bad, no. And just the fact that she took that time out, having not known me so well, to ring me up and just to make me feel good. She spent 40 minutes just basically making me feel good about myself. And I just thought, that is genuinely lovely. And I'm not a superstar, and I'm not someone that can give her a bloody opportunity or someone that she can get something out of. And at that event we went to, when she got up and spoke about women supporting women, and so a couple of women, and I won't, you know, roll their eyes, you know, at the table, kind of, you know, give these kind of glances, and not, I don't even think, no, with no malice or, you know, but just because, you know, it is quite a foreign concept in a lot of ways. And I thought, actually, no, it's easier to say that, but she practices what she preaches. So that's why I felt passionate about actually getting up there and just saying, you know, giving a little example of Delta's not actually just getting up and saying what she thinks, you know, you guys want to hear. She genuinely is that person, and she, reached out to me having not known me and not really needing anything from me. And I always remember that, you know, and I try, you know, even with Beck Madden, you know, I rang her before she went on the show, and I now, any opportunity I can to make someone feel good or better or support someone, particularly women, you know, I'll take, because I now know how it feels to be supported, and it's lovely.
And it means that bit much more. I don't know if it does to you, but to me, when I have somebody, a female who's not that connected to you, support you in some way, means
more.
So much, so much more than if it was
a good friend, or you're right.
Because it's like, okay, you've kind of been there, and for you just to do that, like, that's a beautiful thing to do.
It was lovely. But then it's the same with people like, you know, Lisa Wilkinson is so good with me in that way, and I know that I can go
to... And she adores you. She's been on the couch and she's like, oh, God, she's so gorgeous.
I love her. She is so amazing, and she's someone, in fact... She's the only one that I clicked on and looked at this before I came, right? And I saw a bit of her where she was. I've watched every week, and I'm probably your biggest fan. In fact, all the data that I'm
no, keep going.
Sorry. Oh, don't you worry. From now that I just was bitter, you hadn't used me, but now I'm on, darling. I'll be
all
watching every week. But I didn't know much about it, and I saw where she was talking about the substance of being a journalist first, and how that's what's important, and I just love that about her, because God, she looks amazing and. She's beautiful, and she's got this common touch, but this real elegance, and she's such a wonderful woman. But what's important to her is the journalism and the integrity of what she does and standing up for what she believes in. And she's someone that I look up to so, so much. And same as, you know, Sylvia. I think Sylvia is just doing such a wonderful job on that show as well. And there's so many, Georgie Gardner and so many women at our network, Tracy Grimshaw, that I can look up to and I respect so much. And you know, they all look gorgeous with hair and makeup and get to wear nice things on air, but it's a substance and it's funny, isn't it? Because what I value in people, like once I leave this industry, all I want people to say about me is not that I had good hair or that I wore nice clothes, and not even so much that I was a good journalist, but that'd be nice if they said that. But if people say she was a nice person and she was nice to everyone and she was just nice, then that's all I care about.
Totally.
And that's, you know, it's funny though, because what I value in other people is how they treat people and their substance and their personalities, whereas we're so hard on ourselves when it comes to looks and all that kind of, you know, all right, we're so judgmental, but it's, I couldn't give a flying caboodle what anyone else looks like or, you know, it's
just... And you don't remember, go, oh, she, you know, when you meet, like when we met Lisa Wilkinson, we were fangirling big time.
Yeah, that would have probably been embarrassing for you.
It was so embarrassing.
Just like you were fangirling with me.
Totally, exactly.
Same level.
Like, exactly like that.
Yeah.
But she, you know, and just, there's not, you don't remember, I don't even, don't remember what she was wearing. You don't remember anything about that. When the things you worry about, it's like, I just remember her, like her hug was full of love.
Beautiful.
You know?
She does that, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She actually, and she makes you feel like you're the only person in the world, and she's engaging and she makes you feel special. And it's, you know, it's not easy to do. And particularly in our world where you're constantly The amount of conversations I have with people in our industry who are looking for someone maybe more
Isn't
important
that the
than
worst,
me.
The darting eyes.
Oh, it's just, I hate it. It's like, I just want someone to be like, oi, dipshit.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly fond of you either.
No.
But just be polite. So and if you want to go talk to someone else, go. I know, it is.
Yeah.
It is. So I'm very much when I'm, you know. But yeah, she's wonderful. Very
totally.
Lucky.
In three words, describe what your first kiss was like.
Feral, slobby. Slobby or slobbery? Slobbery.
Slobbery.
Feral, slobbery, and fucking awkward.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Isn't it the best? And you were 17.
Yeah. Well, I was 17. Don't know how old he was. Yeah. I hope you were 17.
Nudist or never nude?
Nudist or never nude?
Yeah.
In what way?
Do you, in your house, do you, are you always nude? Always?
Yeah,
always
I'm pretty much a nudie.
Are you?
Yeah. I like, I wear undies usually, but like I'll run around in the house just in undies.
Yeah.
Like I'll do, like I do my little, my exercise regime. It's very intense. Get your notebooks out if you want to emulate. I do 5 minutes on the treadmill, incline of eight, walking.
Do you have one in your house?
Yeah. And then I do, thanks Rebel Sport, and then I do three kilogram dumbbells, like three sets of like this, this and then that, and I do it nude on the treadmill.
Oh, nude?
I've just started
Any
combining.
Undies?
Yeah, just undies.
Oh, thank
God. So we're kind of nude. We can't sweat
without.
What about
your boobs? Like when you're walking?
They just kind of just hang. They don't really hang. They sit.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's pretty intense. But then, of course, if I hear like the door opening and Sean's coming home, then I start running. Oh, hey, babe. Hey. He's like, I heard you. I heard the volume go up on the thing, the speed increase. I'm like,
but oh, that is
so funny. I'm very much a...
That's such a good visual. You just in your
own... It's,
do you have
shoes on? Thinking, no, I don't wear shoes. I do it barefoot. And actually there is like the window. I often think if some of the lovely paparazzi who like to follow me around other areas actually got there, that would be your shot, doll.
Oh,
that's your
money maker. Seriously, that is your money maker.
Seriously.
I love it.
Yeah.
Last time you threw a tantrum or a hissy fit?
Oh, God. A really big one was probably like a year ago. It was with my ex-boyfriend. Okay, I'll tell it anyway. Why not? He's my ex now anyway. We were at the Hunter Valley, and this is just shows how ridiculously weird women can, well, I can be. I'm not going to put women in this category.
No, we're probably all in there.
Yeah, but I remember I was like in the shower and he came in and he was like packing away stuff and then he like grabbed the toothbrush on the bench and I'd already cleaned my teeth in the shower. And he's like, do you need to clean your teeth yet? And I looked at him and I was like, and that's when I was like, I said, are you trying to say that I need to clean my teeth? Are you trying to say that I'm not good enough? And then it turned into, when you unload the dishwasher, you don't even take out the bottom. And anyway, we had the biggest fight in the world. We left the resort.
Oh,
drove all the way back home, and we were literally about 40 minutes from home, and I looked at him like, I think I overreacted. Because he just wanted to pack it away, and I thought he was trying to basically say that I wasn't good enough as I am.
Isn't it funny?
And that was the last big tantrum, and I think I was like, I can't believe why we didn't work out.
I know, seriously.
I'm really easygoing.
Yeah, you're a real
I
catch.
Actually am. That was a rare moment, but
no,
yeah,
it's
that was...
funny. It
isn't it bizarre,
though?
Your
mood, though.
It
sometimes
would have been
I'm
my
like,
mood. And usually I would have been like, oh, yeah, babe, I'm done with that. Just pack it. But it just went into this whole thing. Then it was like, and when you borrowed that $20 from me last year, you never gave it back, you bastard. Like,
did you argue in an American accent? Too?
No, I just, whenever I'm doing any voice or any past event, I go American or Indian.
Do you?
My darling, did you want your toothbrush? No, honey, I am okay. You know, I just go accents. It's really weird.
Head to showandtellonline.com.au and you can watch those videos with Erin Molan on the couch. Also, make sure you subscribe to our podcast, Show and Tell the Podcast. Lots of great chats with incredible women for you to listen to.